I next met with Dr. Jordan Berlin for a chat about colorectal cancer, and we began by reviewing one of the most controversial topics in the field, adjuvant therapy of patients with stage 2 disease. Dr. Berlin began by presenting a 76-year-old woman from his practice with a well-differentiated adenocarcinoma of the sigmoid colon that was completely resected.
She was a T3N0M0 stage 2 colon cancer with no lymphovascular invasion and no high risk factors. And in fact, actually, what we talked about was initially the cooperative group trial looking at patients' microsatellite instability status and 18q status, and based on that, either treating through a randomized portion or not treating. And she and her daughter enjoyed a lengthy conversation about this, but in the long run, what she said about the trial was, "You mean there's a possibility you'll give me chemotherapy?" And I said, "Yes," and she said basically she didn't want chemotherapy. I'm getting more of that, not just from the 76-year-olds, but from other patients who just don't want to get the chemotherapy unless I can clearly tell them that it's going to benefit them. And as you know, stage 2 remains controversial as to whether or not patients get benefit.
Well, I guess one thing in terms of, quote, chemotherapy, particularly adjuvant chemotherapy that you all have in colon cancer that is not really available in terms of, for example, breast cancer, is capecitabine, an oral agent that doesn't cause alopecia. I mean, not necessarily 100% easy to use. Do you ever use that alone without oxali as adjuvant therapy?
I will sometimes in stage 2, which I have to admit is extrapolating data. The real data for capecitabine versus 5-FU and leucovorin was in stage 3 colon cancer. The exact trial was purely a stage 3 trial, and it's a very reasonable adjuvant therapy to give capecitabine alone in patients for whom you're not contemplating oxaliplatin for stage 3. But also, I've used that extrapolation for patients who don't want to take the highest risk and who have good kidney function, obviously, because capecitabine has to be given with good kidney function. To give them capecitabine alone seems a very reasonable alternative. However, for stage 2 disease, where I have used it once in a while in certain patients, I have to admit that the data is not firmly there that it's equivalent to 5-FU and leucovorin, but I would have to say I find it hard to believe it's not.
So, for example, if you think about this particular woman, and I don't know exactly what her objections or concerns were about chemotherapy, how do you think she would have felt about capecitabine?
Actually, I did offer her capecitabine. She didn't want capecitabine either, but she really just didn't want therapy. So I did choose a patient, and she's the most recent patient I have. She's just coming to her six-month evaluation now, I think. She's a patient who really, really just did not want chemotherapy, period. She came in with that thought. Her daughter did not come in with that thought. So her daughter was thinking chemotherapy and thought the capecitabine was a nice compromise between systemic or IV chemotherapy versus not doing therapy at all. And, you know, the one thing I have to stress is capecitabine is not as toxic as the Mayo Clinic regimen, 5-FU and leucovorin, but it's not really been as clearly compared and shown to be less toxic than the infusional 5-FU regimens. And, of course, in this country, there's a little bit more issue of more toxicity than there are in other continents. Europe and Asia have less toxicity problems from the capecitabine. So there are some cautions that have to be used with capecitabine. Nonetheless, it's generally a fairly well-tolerated drug. If the patients don't have a large copay, it's actually a great alternative, and they enjoy not having to be in the chemo room.
Now, you know, another issue about adjuvant therapy, particularly in the stage 2 situation, is whether or not you're going to offer to the patient any kind of numbers about what you think their risk of relapse might be and how that might be affected by therapy. That's done a lot in breast cancer. I'm not so sure if it's done as much in colorectal cancer. Do you generally offer it to the patient? For example, in this woman, did you say, "Would you like to hear numbers about what I think your risk of this coming back is?"
I try to offer them numbers. There are some websites that offer numbers that help you guide a little bit more than just staying stage 2 in general, where it's a fairly broad thing. The breast cancer have really knocked down the risks based on receptor status. They have a very detailed risk. There are some websites like that for colorectal cancer. But the thing about the colon cancer is a lot of that data is, you know, from earlier trials and times when we didn't always have such good scans as we have now. So there are some risks in interpreting that data. But nonetheless, the QUASAR data in general for stage 2 colon cancer really shows about a 3% benefit overall for chemotherapy. And that's what really, I think, did it for this woman and convinced her daughter, maybe not, because really that means in a stage two patient, this one is a very good risk patient. I mean, I mentioned her because she's a very good risk. There were no bad risk prognostic factors. You know, at most, we're going to benefit 3 out of 100 patients. So 97, if I were to treat all the patients like her, 97 would take all the risks of the chemotherapy for no benefit. And that's a big issue to me.
Did you also give her a number in terms of what you thought her chance of a cancer relapse would be?
Well, I told her the general number of about a 1 in 5 risk, which probably she's a little bit lower because she's a good risk stage two.
Right. And so with those kinds of numbers, you know, there are people who won't be treated for even a greater benefit than 3%. So she falls into somebody who, looking at capecitabine for a 3% absolute benefit, didn't want to be treated. Any kind of sense what sort of the tipping point would have been in this woman in terms of absolute benefit in order to, say, for example, get capecitabine?
I think if her risks were higher.
Right.
I don't think any benefit, unless I told her it would be a 100% chance that her cancer wouldn't come back, she would have needed a higher risk of the cancer coming back because, again, she's 76 years old, and she also looked at the age factors and how much she wanted to spend 6 months getting therapy. A younger patient might be different, and I've had several younger patients, and some of whom on the ECOG trial, and we've always been surprised. One of the things about the ECOG trial that surprised us is that the patients who I really thought would have the general low risk factor came back with high risk factors, were microsatellite stable and 18q deleted, and ended out needing to go on to the chemotherapy. So one of the things you can't do is look at the pathology and predict those two status.
So one of the things that oncologists in practice are utilizing in breast cancer that hasn't been available, or nothing like it really has been available in colorectal cancer, has been the Oncotype DX assay. And now at the last ASCO meeting, there was some data coming off the QUASAR study looking at an RT-PCR assay in colon cancer. What was your take in terms of the key points from the presentation there, and what did it mean to you?
That Oncotype presentation was very interesting, very intriguing. I think good preliminary data that there may be something for us similar to what the breast cancer people are using. I think it needs further study before I would apply it routinely.
You know, it kind of looked like, in getting into this 3% thing, there when they were using their assay, I think there was one group that was the, quote, higher risk at 22%, and then another one lower risk around 11%. You know, you multiply a relative risk factor of 20%, for example, in the QUASAR study, and you might get 3%, or you might get, you know, 5 or 6 or 7%. If those numbers actually play out, do you think they'll be useful to docs in practice?
Oh, I think they could be. I mean, you know, again, the higher risk groups, once you get over the 20%, I think that group of patients, it can be useful. The question is, will it really be useful above and beyond what we already have? I mean, when we take a patient who's poorly differentiated or has lymphovascular invasion, those two groups of patients, a lot of us will be more interested in adjuvant therapy for those groups. And, you know, when you looked at, for example, just looking at those factors, you can't take this as being good data, but when they looked at the data from the MOSAIC trial with FOLFOX, they looked at stage two patients. There wasn't an overall survival benefit, but when they took these types of risk factors that we can already identify from simple histopathology, they identified a group that did appear to get benefit. And that's retrospective subset analysis within a prospective trial, but it was still very intriguing data also. And I think similar to the Oncotype DX type data, intriguing and should be tested further, actually, to me, states that we may have a simpler way of doing it without having to do another expensive test.
Now, what about trials, clinical trials in the adjuvant colon setting? We've had, I guess, results that have been considered disappointing in bevacizumab at the last ASCO meeting, and now I understand, I think, the adjuvant cetuximab study has been closed. Is that correct?
Yes. So the adjuvant cetuximab study was interesting. When they first started, of course, we didn't test for KRAS, and so they changed the trial and changed the statistics to fit a KRAS wild-type only population. And despite the fact that they were taking KRAS wild-type only population, they hit a futility boundary and closed the study based on the futility boundary and the recommendation of the Data Safety Monitoring Committee. So that study is going to be negative as well when it's officially reported, most likely at ASCO 2010.
So where are we right now in terms of new research ideas in the adjuvant setting?
Well, I think we need new drugs. The problem that we have is that we've now gone sort of to this looking at very small differences. And it's understandable. We've got great success in adjuvant therapy of colon cancer. So you almost need to look at smaller differences. It makes it hard to test a new drug without any evidence of activity in the advanced setting. But there are drugs that may be better in the adjuvant setting than they be in the advanced setting. Some of the new targeted agents may be better in the adjuvant setting, and I couldn't tell you which ones those are in advance, but one would suspect some of the things that have mechanisms of action that really prevent metastasis formation would be better in the adjuvant setting. Immune therapies may be better in the adjuvant setting than in the metastatic setting, and those probably need to be tested there. However, I think you need some hint of activity in the metastatic setting because it takes so many patients. You have to invest so much time in so many patients. So I think the real question that's left right now is what is the duration of therapy? And then there is a question that the intergroup is at least thinking about, which is the COX-2. COX-2 overexpression has impact on prognosis. COX-2 may be one of those targets that may be more important in the adjuvant setting than in the metastatic setting. COX-2 inhibition had no effect on the metastatic setting in the BICC or BICC-C trial with celecoxib, but celecoxib may have an impact on the adjuvant setting, and so they are considering that in the intergroup. They're also considering the question, can you reduce the duration of therapy and therefore reduce the toxicity? Because as you know, the oxaliplatin has a cumulative neuropathy.
Let's discuss another patient from your practice. How about the 57-year-old man with liver-only mets who got panitumumab? And incidentally, how often do you use this agent as opposed to cetuximab?
So I have several people who have gotten panitumumab. We tend to use a little bit more panitumumab off clinical trials here in our area because of the high risk of infusion reactions with cetuximab, that our area has a 21% infusion reaction rate. And when you present that data to the patients, it makes it a little bit more nerve-wracking to risk the cetuximab, especially those rare ones who've had oxaliplatin infusion reactions. They know what an infusion reaction feels like, and it's much rarer with oxaliplatin, but we've had a few. So, you know, I do have one gentleman who's gotten it in the earlier setting. A lot of my patients, we discuss the risks and benefits for doing panitumumab in the earlier settings. We have not used it in the first-line setting at our institution, but of course we had a second-line panitumumab trial, and the data for panitumumab and for cetuximab both in second-line really support more progression-free survival benefit and response rate benefit, and so there are reasons to do it. The gentleman that I have is a 57-year-old gentleman who presented with oligometastatic liver metastases. There was some concern about being able to resect his disease, so we went ahead and gave him FOLFOX chemotherapy first-line, and he progressed right through it. So we went on to panitumumab plus FOLFIRI in hopes for a better response to be able to get his tumor away from the portal vein so he could be resected. And currently he is starting to respond, which is nice. Obviously, we use a lot more panitumumab. There is a little bit of convenience factor in the every other week schedule, but there is data for every other week schedules in cetuximab as well. He was actually diagnosed concurrently. He presented with obstruction and had a resection and was found to have liver metastases biopsied. And when they did CT scan pre-op, it looked like there were 3 liver metastases, but there were 5 on the PET scan when they looked at it. And so there were 5 liver metastases, but there's one crucial one that's right next to the portal vein, and it's not clear that it can be freed up. It's right at the bifurcation. And so that would be a crucial one that would be very difficult to resect. Otherwise, all his disease is in the right lobe. His left lobe is not particularly large, but it's large enough to be considered for surgical resection of the right lobe, from what my surgeons say. But unfortunately, he's a rare case for us, a patient who progressed right through his first rounds of FOLFOX. We don't see that a lot, but it happens, and he progressed right through, and that did not make him more resectable, to say the least. But he didn't get more metastases, so we're still hopeful.
So how do you generally approach patients who are going to receive neoadjuvant or preoperative therapy in the hopes of converting them to resectability in terms of choice of therapy? You mentioned you use FOLFOX. Is that what you normally use? And what about bevacizumab?
So we actually have several patients who are getting neoadjuvant therapy these days for their liver metastases, their oligometastatic disease. And we tend to favor FOLFOX in that setting. It is based on limited data. One of the limitations is that there's not a lot of data for FOLFIRI in that setting. And there is a lot more data, including randomized data for FOLFOX in that setting in terms of the European trial of neoadjuvant and post-op adjuvant therapy with FOLFOX. And there's a lot more safety data for that regimen to give FOLFOX therapy in terms of what kind of liver damage might happen from the chemotherapy. The truth is that you can get steatohepatitis from either FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, but based on the data from Nick Fauthey's group at MD Anderson, it suggests that you get more steatohepatitis from FOLFIRI regimens than FOLFOX regimens, and steatohepatitis increases the complication rate from the surgery, and therefore we've stuck with FOLFOX. In terms of bevacizumab, we actually have used bevacizumab in this setting. What we normally do is plan for 4 doses of the FOLFOX, but the 4th dose comes without the bevacizumab, so that way there's a 6-week window prior to the surgical resection. There's not as much data for the bevacizumab as to whether or not it really adds to the resectability rate or anything else, but because this is, at the time, metastatic disease and we're not entirely sure they'll get to surgery, we would rather add in the bevacizumab in the first-line regimen than in the second-line regimen, although obviously there is data for bevacizumab as either first- or second-line therapy.
So how long was it on the FOLFOX before you felt like he was progressing?
Oh, we actually had a large rise in the CEA after 2 cycles. So we got the CEA back after he got in the 2nd dose, and we got prior to the 3rd dose, and there was significant progression.
And where is he right now? You said you put him on panitumumab and FOLFIRI.
Right. Actually, he's had 4 doses of the FOLFIRI plus panitumumab. We debated whether or not to use the 5-FU and leucovorin portion of it and decided to go ahead with it. There's not as much data for FOLFIRI versus irinotecan after FOLFOX as there is for FOLFOX after irinotecan and 5-FU. But nonetheless, we went with the FOLFIRI. He's gotten 4 doses. His CEA has dropped, and his CT scan shows about a 10% decrease in the tumors. So we're hoping for a little bit more of a decrease at the time of the next scan.
And how's he tolerating therapy?
He's tolerating therapy very well. We actually used the data from the, well, we didn't use the full data, the STEP trial, which I hope I'm naming the trial right, the trial that looked at trying to go after the skin toxicity early. We started him with minocycline and recommended some moisturizing creams from the start of his chemotherapy and panitumumab, and he has not had very severe facial rash.
Any overall impression in terms of tolerability of panitumumab, particularly compared to cetuximab?
I think the tolerability is fairly similar for the two drugs. They both cause rash in a significant number of patients. The rash seems to be fairly similar. We see hypomagnesemia in the same numbers. The difference, of course, for us, and that makes the big difference, is the infusion reaction rate. But we continue to have cetuximab trials, and we continue to use cetuximab at the current time.
What about efficacy comparing the two EGFR antibodies?
Oh, I think that there's really no significant difference. You know, you're really comparing trial to trial, but if you look at the trial data, there's no data that strongly supports a significant difference between the two.
So you're routinely using this sort of preemptive approach to skin toxicity?
Not necessarily routinely, but fairly often. There was a lot of things listed in the STEP trial that they did. We mostly just used the minocycline and moisturizing creams, and of course recommend sunblock when they're outdoors, those types of things. But we're focusing on that. I'm at least using it. I can't say that that's the case for all my colleagues. I'm not sure. But I'm using it prophylactically for either one of the two EGFR antibodies. The patients don't enjoy the rash, and if you can minimize it, they do appreciate it.
And you mentioned the infusion reactions that have been seen in the so-called, I guess, infusion belt. Can you kind of review that? What's the area? And there's been worked on in New England Journal, et cetera, in terms of trying to identify the pathogenesis.
Well, there's nothing like writing a couple articles to get some interesting information. So we've seen the infusion reaction. This was worked on by UNC Sarah Cannon Research Institute and Vanderbilt to try and define, at least to some extent, the geographic location. And what we did was we identified the percentage in our 3 institutions more than anything else. And we got a 21% infusion reaction rate. And by that, we mean the acute infusion reactions, the hypotension and the sometimes confusion. We get a large number of those. What was interesting is then at Vanderbilt, we worked with some other institutions, including an allergist at University of Virginia, and we found the specific etiology of the allergy. We have an IgE antibody that pre-exists in the same percentage of the normal population that's never received this drug in our region. in 21% of the population, we have an IgE antibody to a glycoprotein that's attached to the antibody after manufacture, but it's part of the current drug. And so that's where the problem is. What we haven't identified is, why do we have this IgE antibody in such a high percentage of our patients in this area? Well, we think the region really revolves around, in terms of North Carolina and Tennessee, it goes a little bit north of Tennessee into Kentucky, but not all the way to northern Kentucky. And it goes into Alabama and Georgia and Mississippi, but not all the way south to the south end of those states. There's also some, at least, increased risk in parts of Missouri and Kansas. More recently, intriguingly, I got a phone call from Czechoslovakia, where they claim they're seeing similar rates of infusion reactions. So it makes it even more intriguing that there may be this group in Czechoslovakia. Now, I've not been able to confirm, you know, what the percentage is there, but that does raise an interesting question, because I'm not entirely aware of what we could be exposed to that's an antigen in such a narrow belt.
I guess at one point I'd heard something about maybe trees or something like that.
Well, a lot of us think it's a tree or a fungus or something like that, because one of the other intriguing aspects is, if you look in Tennessee, much of Tennessee, like Nashville, Chattanooga, and Memphis, are largely towards sea level. But we have the plateau with Knoxville and Johnson City and several other cities, and it doesn't seem like the infusion reaction rate is as high up on the plateau at a higher elevation. So it's an intriguing question. Is there something that lives more at our elevation? And it's hard to believe what kind of plant or tree. Certainly it's not ornamental, because those things have spread all over the United States. Anything that's attractive and people put in gardens are everywhere.
How do you see, you know, sort of outside the infusion belt, the comparison of these two EGFR antibodies in terms of choice of therapy?
Oh, I think in that case, it's six of one, half dozen of another. You know, the only difference might be schedule, but like I said, there is data for an every other week schedule for cetuximab. So really, outside the infusion belt, it's not really much of a risk. You know, they have a 1% infusion reaction rate compared to ours.
I'm curious, in this man, how you would have approached it if his primary tumor was asymptomatic. And, you know, the question of patients who present with asymptomatic primary colon cancer with metastatic disease, is it resectable or non?
So, of course, Vanderbilt was one of the first institutions to present the retrospective data that suggested that if you took a patient who was asymptomatic and did not resect them at the time of presentation, that very few patients, I think in our case it was 2 out of 81, ever needed to go to resection. Now, there are, of course, maybe some confounding factors that some of them got too sick and they just didn't take them to resection. But the bottom line is that you don't need it a lot. The situation, though, with bevacizumab has changed a few things, in that I don't think I would have normally taken a mildly bleeding primary to resection originally, but now we might consider it a little bit more, especially if they're considering going on a clinical trial. If they're not going on a clinical trial, you could give them chemotherapy and add the bevacizumab when the bleeding has clearly stopped, because the primaries do respond to the chemotherapy better than the metastases from what we can tell. But again, that data is not well established.
Now, this man, of course, wasn't resectable, but if he had, there's also the controversy about whether to give patients who are resectable neoadjuvant systemic therapy or just wait until after the surgery. What's your approach to that?
If they can be cut out, we cut them out. Until the data is there firmly that this should be the approach over postoperative therapy, the thing is that in terms of the oligometastatic disease, is that is a potentially curative surgery, and we don't necessarily want to delay it. And even though the risks of steatohepatitis are lower with FOLFOX than with FOLFIRI, you can get steatohepatitis from 5-FU alone, and so we could increase the complication rate. So we tend to favor cutting it out. There are others who do it, the neoadjuvant approach, and I don't think that there's necessarily anything wrong with that approach. But we favor, if it can be cut out at the time of presentation, to cut it out. Now, patients who present simultaneously with synchronous metastases, we may be more concerned about them, particularly rectal cancer patients, since it's a more difficult surgical approach. Those patients, we may give the neoadjuvant approach to make sure they don't declare themselves as a very aggressive tumor.
What is your usual first-line systemic therapy in metastatic colon cancer?
FOLFIRI plus bevacizumab.
And I know that's been an interesting answer. It's a lot different than what some of the other investigators say. What's your thought behind that, both in terms of the FOLFIRI as well as the bevacizumab?
Well, of course, the other investigators are wrong. So here's the situation, is that generally you're on the first regimen that you receive the longest, if you're a patient, that is. And the fact is that FOLFIRI and FOLFOX both have toxicities. There's no question. FOLFIRI has a little more diarrhea and a little bit more alopecia, but the fact is that neither one of those two is a cumulative toxicity, but neuropathy is. Even with using the Optimox-type regimen where you stop and start the oxaliplatin, which allows you to extend out the oxaliplatin and decrease the neuropathy through the initial treatment, sooner or later you're going to run into the neuropathy. And so we tend to favor a regimen in patients who have clearly unresectable metastatic disease of FOLFIRI to avoid the cumulative toxicity until later in their lives. Quality of life has to be much more important now that we're making patients live a lot longer. And so that's why we favor it. I will say that sitting here in a music studio by Music Row in Nashville, you have to understand almost everybody in Nashville is a musician. I think I'm the only one who's not. And so they have an even larger interest in not getting neuropathic because music is important to them. Even if they're not famous and they're not recording, playing the music is important, and not being able to feel your fingers well enough to play the guitar may be very important. So that may have driven us initially a little bit more than other places. And I think that's why we started with the FOLFIRI. But we've been quite happy with it.
Now, your choice of biologic is similar to what most both investigators and docs in practice are using, bevacizumab. What's your experience been with the drug in terms of tolerability and complications?
Of course, we actually participated in both the original IFL with or without bevacizumab trial, the Hurwitz trial. We actually were one of the institutions on the paper. And we also participated in ECOG 3200 and a couple of other trials with bevacizumab. And the reality was that we had a tough time discerning who was receiving the bevacizumab. There is the hypertension, but ironically, the person who stayed on that regimen on the first trial, the longest, the Hurwitz trial, had hypertension develop on the trial, but actually wasn't receiving bevacizumab. It just gained weight. The bottom line is that I think bevacizumab is a very well-tolerated drug. Now, I will admit that I tend to avoid using it in patients with high risk factors for the thromboembolic or the arterial complications, because that's a crucial issue. If I have a patient with a history of angina that's not been treated, or coronary artery disease that's fairly severe with a stroke or heart attack or something like that, I'm much more cautious about my use of bevacizumab.
Now, you were part of the Bright Tumor Registry project. Can you talk about what that looked at and what the implications are from your point of view?
Well, the Bright Tumor Registry project was, I think, originally an FDA concept that they wanted to have them do a tumor registry to look at a more wide-based population. But I have to admit and realize I was part of the steering committee for this, and that's why I'm on the papers, because we guided a lot of this. They've made good use of it. I think that the data that's out there has posited some intriguing concepts. It confirmed that populations such as the elderly population can tolerate this drug. There were a lot more elderly patients on the Bright trial than there were on the original metastatic randomized trials. It also showed a lot more about the drug in general, and it did bring up the question, should you continue bevacizumab beyond progression? Now, I'm one of the people who believes that the data presented in the Growthy article about bevacizumab beyond progression is solely hypothesis generating. We do not use bevacizumab beyond progression in our institution. I wouldn't recommend it, not knowing for certain whether or not it helps, but it certainly motivates us to want to participate in trials like the SWOG trial that does look at bevacizumab beyond progression and ask the questions.
I guess the clinical scenario that I've heard people talk about is the patient who has a very good and prolonged response to chemo bevacizumab. You know, maybe somebody who was symptomatic, rapidly progressing, and then, you know, maybe on bevacizumab alone after having had the chemo stopped, has slow progression. The question again of, you know, maybe keeping the bevacizumab going and switching the chemo. So even in that situation, you don't do that.
Well, again, we don't run into the problem of having to switch the chemo because we don't use the drug that causes cumulative toxicity.
Right.
So that probably has not motivated us. I would say that if I had a patient who got good results from FOLFOX, but on 5-FU leucovorin alone started progressing with 5-FU leucovorin bevacizumab, but I couldn't reinstate the oxaliplatin because of the neuropathy, that may be a situation where I would switch to FOLFIRI plus bevacizumab, because we're still optimoxing them, as the vernacular now goes, in some way. There are probably situations in which I would consider it where they haven't truly progressed. But if they've truly progressed on their prior regimens, I'm hesitant to do it. I've used bevacizumab in second line in patients who've also, we have patients take long breaks. There are groups of patients who cannot take breaks on chemotherapy, but there are others who can. If they've taken a long break, but we need to switch the regimen, I'm still okay using bevacizumab second line in that situation, because I can always use the EGFR inhibitors third line.
Any other new agents coming along in colorectal cancer that, you know, we're waiting for results for, that maybe some sense of optimism about?
Well, I've got some biases. I was the principal investigator, so remember there's a bias here, of a Sonic Hedgehog inhibitor trial in first-line therapy. It's a randomized phase 2 trial, but I'm certainly intrigued and would like to see what the results of that are.